So there was a season when a group of my buddies and I used to get together about every 2 or 3 months and go to a movie all together. And the plan was always kind of the same. We show up at the movie theater for movie time, grab our stuff, go in, watch the movie, and then afterwards we go out over beer, sit around and yak and talk. And normally, one guy was always organizing it. He would send out a number of different movies we could choose. And I could always tell of the 5 different movies or 3 different movies he'd send out, I knew what was going to be the one. You know, it was always the crazy shoot 'em up action, thriller, or, you know, the typical guy fare, you know, Schwarzenegger, or, yeah, Van Damme. It was, you know, kind of, that's what you'd come to expect. So anyways, this one night, this was back in 2007, a whole bunch of us, same thing, we showed up at West Hills Theater to watch a movie called Gone Baby Gone. I don't know if anyone's ever seen this movie. Starring Casey Affleck. It was one of the first times I'd ever seen him. And I was expecting a gritty crime, suspense, thriller kind of thing. And as per usual, we got our popcorn, we all headed in, and we're all laughing, goofing off just before the movie gets rolling. Someone's cracking jokes, and I feel bad for everyone around because we're so obnoxious and loud. But all of a sudden, the movie starts. And I'm telling you, within a very short time, the mood on our row shifted drastically. I mean, and it took us on a trip not one of us was expecting. Now, it was done back in 2007, so I'm sorry, there's going to be spoiler alerts all over the place. If you even watch it now, I'm sorry, 7 years later, it's your phone fault, all right? So, the movie is about a mom's desperate search to find her 4-year-old girl who goes missing. And so the police is doing a big investigation, but she goes and she hires private investigators, a couple, to augment the search. And the search takes them into some ugly, ugly places, dark and disturbing situations that no parent of young children would ever want to see or to think about. And I mean, you're wading through this movie, and I couldn't help it, but my imagination is going to very dark places to what happened to that girl. And there's this feeling of dread. I'm just going, oh no, we're not going to like the ending of this thing. This is not good. In the end, they find the girl alive, and she's healthy. And just as I'm about to feel this, that's when it gets crazy again. Because the mom, who I thought was loving and caring and so desperate to find her little girl that she's taken such good care of, isn't the kind of mom I thought she was. And I'm sitting there going, oh no. And the guy who kidnapped her isn't this deviant, disturbed pervert that I was expecting in my mind. No, actually, he was trying to protect this little girl from her mom. And now the investigative couple who are involved in this, who are just discovering this is all kind of coming out. They have a very difficult decision to make. You want to talk about some complex moral dilemmas this movie created. You know, I remember watching this. My head hurt and my heart was sick. We walked out of that theater. Normally we'd be goofing off with each other and pranking someone on the way down the hallway and going out for beer. And instead we found ourselves in this big argument in the lobby. We didn't even go out for beer that night. One guy was saying, no, he did the right thing. The other one's going, are you kidding me? Did the right thing. I mean, this movie created this sick gray mess where it didn't seem like there was one right way to handle it. And here was this little girl caught in the middle of the complexity. Oh man, I went home that night. I'd still to this day, when this movie comes up, someone says, Gone Baby Gone, what's it? I just go, oh, don't talk about that one. That one makes me sick. The fact that there's situations like this that happen where there's no clear right or wrong and just doesn't resolve. Have you ever had those kind of moments when life presents complexities and challenges and it twists you up? Some experience it when something very serious or tragic happens in their lives. Sometimes it's a loved one that passes away. Sometimes it's a serious diagnosis of some sort. You see an injustice that just doesn't make sense. And all of a sudden, you find yourself plunged deep below the surface of the normal, mundane, everyday life. The shallow world of activity, way below. To a depth where you're forced to wrestle with something that you can't seem to reconcile. I have a feeling all of us have been there in one way or another, haven't we? And you begin asking those deep, dark questions of God, of life. A number of years ago, I was in a discussion with a bunch of people. It was a small group, actually, from our Friends Church community. And we were together, we're sitting around, and we're discussing, and of all things, it was a topic about who in the end gets to go to heaven. And it was a question that we used to bat around a lot way back in the day. And there's different people that were throwing in their opinions, and it was interesting. This one guy weighed in. He'd been a friend I've had since I was a teenager. He brought up his Hindu parents. You see, he was raised Hindu. He said, here are the most devoted, loving, and kind people I know. They poured their lives into the only faith and belief system they've ever known to connect with who they believed was God. And it seems that you guys, what you guys are saying is that because they were born into a Hindu family and religion, were never introduced to this man named Jesus or the Christian faith, that they aren't connected with your God. And unless they do it the Christian way, unless they do it the way that you're supposed to do it in Christianity, they will never connect with God. They will never know what heaven is. They won't go there. Is that right? Is that what you guys are saying here? And I had to admit that's how I was brought up to believe. And I saw heads kind of painfully nodding. And I remember in that moment, I'm going, no. I can't reconcile that. I'm not sure I agree with that. I don't know. And everyone's looking at me going, Jeff, you don't know. And I'm going, honestly, I don't know. I'm not signing off on that. Since then, it seems like on a weekly basis, I'm encountering issues and quandaries between my spiritual beliefs, some that I've been raised with, some that I'm acquired, and what I witness in real life. You know what I mean? Stuff presents itself, and I'm going, okay, just wait a second. Now, how does that work? I've wrestled with the Bible and what it is. What is this thing? And how am I supposed to really use it? Because sometimes it says some troubling things that I don't want to buy into. That doesn't make sense of God I love and how he wants to interact with this world. I've wrestled with prayer. What is it? Like, are there really formulas to getting God to twist his arm to make him answer my prayer? You know, maybe you've gotten the email. Someone says, hey, we need everyone praying on this one. And the more we can get you praying, oh, this little girl or this situation will turn around. And I'm thinking, is that how it works? So the people with the biggest prayer network get their prayers answered. God says, okay, you have 50. Yeah, you guys only had 3. And if you pray the right way, okay, all right, good. You get blue skies for your outdoor wedding. But you know what? You over here, Mom, over in Rwanda, dealing with the genocide, because you don't know how to pray, my hands are tied. Like, I've wrestled with these things. I just go, oh, what is prayer anyways? What is God's role to begin with? Like, does he just airbomb in and perform little miracles for some people, and then he chooses not to for others? the last few years, 5 or 6, I've wrestled over this whole area of homosexuality because I know how I was raised. And like probably most everyone in the room, you've heard certain people want to read out scripture and say, ah, see, see? And yet I know the lives of the people that I've gotten to know, many of them friends of mine from growing up, come out and I'm looking at them. I mean, I don't claim to know people's insides of their hearts, but I'm telling you, I know these people and I'm looking at them and I'm going, okay, this doesn't make sense. And there's these conflicts rise up inside of me. I'm going, I'm not okay with just towing a party line when real life doesn't make sense of this. You guys know what I'm saying? Wrestling. There's times when deep down inside, I'm wrestling through the stuff. And then I got to get up here and talk to you guys. And I'm scared spitless. Because I'm scared if I'm really honest with you about some of the stuff I'm wrestling, I'm going to freak you guys out. More often than not, I've had some people come up and go, don't talk about stuff that you're not really sure about, because that freaks me out. Because if you're not sure, how am I supposed to be sure? And I'm going, I guess I'll lie then. I guess I'll stand up here and just the way. Somehow in my mind, it was always a sign of spiritual weakness to struggle with doubt and uncertainty, to experience disillusionment. I mean, only the weak do that. I mean, the real spiritual giants, I thought, were the people of unwavering faith who could read something and not question it. Second guess, no, never. They knew what they believed and weren't deterred by others' people's slick emotional arguments. No, we don't pay attention to those things. No, we just believe it. You say it, I just believe it. They walk with confidence and boldness and certainty. They believe it and they didn't doubt. Perhaps there's people in this room that were taught that too. Maybe you, like me, have secretly felt guilty or ashamed for questioning at times. I bet there are people in this room who have quietly, even coming in here on a Sunday, have heard me say something or Vince say something and go, oh, just wait a second, I'm not sure I'd buy this. But you're not going to come up and say, hey, I think you missed it. No, I'll just keep it to myself. I don't know. Yeah. And at times it's probably left you in tension, uncertain, wondering, doubting maybe your own faith or your own spirituality. It has for me. Question. What if I told you that doubt and uncertainty is actually a sign of spiritual development and maturity? What do you think? Would you believe me? That it's actually a sign of a more developed faith. There's a well-known psychiatrist and best-selling author named Scott Peck. Maybe some of you will be familiar with him. He was big a number of years back. Probably most well-known for his book, The Road Less Traveled. Sold over 10 million copies. The guy had vaulted him into a whole realm of speaking. He was a spiritual guy. And he had walked, his spiritual journey was amazing. But he wrote a book called The Different Drum that I remember reading years ago. And it's funny, I picked it up more just in the last year and a bit after having read it years ago. And now it's speaking to me even more now than it did then. But it's a clarion call for people to live in community, meaningful community. Anyways, within the book, he begins to unpack some stuff that he had done through research. And he was in conjunction with another guy named James Fowler, who did a ton of research on people's spiritual development. Anyways, borrowing from some of that work and some of his own work, Peck lays out 4 levels of spiritual development, starting with the first level, first stage, what he calls ego. No, He doesn't call it ego. He calls it chaotic antisocial. I call it ego, and you'll see why. He uses these psychological words that mean probably nothing to you. At least they didn't for me, so I'm going to put in ego because he describes it. Anyways, this, he just says, is the lowest stage of spiritual development, which he says is basically an absent spirituality. He would say at this level, people are incapable of loving others. Though they can pretend to love, their whole intention and motivation is self-motivated. They're all about themselves. And so they can love, but really they're just masking this down deep, this agenda to get something. He said this is the basic, most basic, lowest level of spiritual development. And this is where the ego is at play. You're just focused on yourself. Anyways, second stage is what he would refer to as blind faith. According to Peck, this is the level where typically fundamentalists sit. Now, again, these are just broad strokes. You tell me if you can relate to some of this stuff, or generally speaking, people at this stage are characterized by legalistic, parochial, dogmatic behavior. People in this stage of faith are threatened by anyone who thinks differently than they do. They see their truth, small t, as capital T truth, the truth. You don't believe what we believe? I'm worried about you. It is the way, the only way. You see it my way, or you must be on level one. That's a funny thing. They're religious for clear-cut answers. They long for a security of a big daddy God and organization to escape the fear of living in the mystery of life, the mystery of uncertainty in the ever-moving and ever-expanding universe and unknown. Instead, these people will choose the formulations, the stagnation of prescribed methods and doctrines that spell out life and attempt to escape fear. Fear is a big word for people in this category. They fear being introduced to something different, so they lock it down. He says, this is typical of stage two. Interesting, one day Jesus told a group of people a parable. I mean, and a parable would be just being, he'd tell a story, and within it, he wouldn't even have to tell what lesson he was trying to tell. He would just tell the story, but the story would teach. And at the end of the parable, he looks at the people and he says this. He says, are you listening? And then he says, are you really listening? His disciples come up to him afterwards and they go, okay, what's the deal with the stories? Why do you tell them stories? Interesting what he says. Listen very carefully. He says, whenever someone has a ready heart for this, what I'm saying, the insights and the understandings flow freely. But if there is no readiness, any trace of receptivity soon disappears. Any readiness. That's why I tell stories, to create readiness, to nudge the people toward receptive insight. In their present state, they can stare till doomsday and not see it. Listen till they're blue in the face and not get it. He says, I don't want Isaiah's forecast repeated all over again. So now he's quoting a prophet from the Old Testament. And this is what the prophet said. He said, your ears are open, but you don't hear a thing. Your eyes are awake, but you don't see a thing. The people are blockheads. This is a great translation, isn't it? They stick their fingers in their ears so they won't have to listen. They screw their eyes shut so they won't have to look. Jesus says, I don't want that repeated here. So I tell these stories, and I'm hoping people are actually seeing and hearing. Could it be that what Jesus was specifically referring to in that moment were those in the crowd who are stuck in stage two of their faith development? People who wanted to lock it down, have it all scripted out, who feel a level of fear by having anything else introduced to them. And they're going, no, no, no. Can't hear. No, I know the truth. I'm a Seth Godin fan. I don't know if anyone in here is familiar with Seth Godin. He's a brilliant author on marketing specifically and influencing people. He has his blog written by or read by millions every day. If you read much of his work, you'll know that one of his favorite topics is challenging people to step out and do the hard work, the difficult, deep thinking, and risky work to explore the unknown, mysterious territory, the wrestling that makes your brain ache. He says, do the hard work. Because everyone's doing the easy work. No one wants to do the hard work. You want to set yourself out, do the hard work. In order to do that, though, he says, you have to overcome lizard brain. I love this terminology, lizard brain, which isn't new to him. He didn't invent it. It's kind of a evolutionary description. Anyways, he says it's the part of us everyone has that's driven by fear, fights the unknown, the scary. This is what he says. He said the lizard brain only wants to eat and be safe. Lizard brain will fight if it has to the death, but would rather run away. It likes a vendetta. It has no problem getting angry. You corner it and it'll get angry. The lizard brain cares what everyone else thinks because status quo in the tribe is essential to its survival. The lizard brain is the reason you're afraid. You don't have to do all the art. The reason you don't do all the art you can, the reason you don't ship, which is his word for producing the good stuff, exploring that the potential inside of you, the reason you don't ship when you can, that's the lizard brain. That's why you're listening to it. The lizard brain is the source of the resistance. Of fear. Stage two, there's a lot of fear. Let me ask you something. Have you ever spoken with someone who is so close to exploring an unknown area? Where there's a belief, theological discussion you're having with them, something goes on, and all of a sudden, as soon as you start talking or sharing something that's different than what they believe, all of a sudden you see a reaction, visceral reaction on them. You start nodding their head. Tell their heart starting to race a bit. They're like, oh no, 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 no. And they're not even listening. Now what they're thinking about is what they're going to say. And they're just waiting for you to quit talking. Because they have some correcting to do. The defensiveness comes out. They're ready to prove that you're on the wrong track. They can't accept that there's maybe more than one way to look at this thing. That's stage two behavior, according to Scott Peck. What's ironic is that the people who Jesus continually referenced as being blind, these people, were the spiritual guides of his day. Isn't that scary? I'm very sobered by that. That could be me. They were the ones who were convinced they had it all figured out. But again and again, Jesus looked at them and said, you hide behind your legalism and your rules and your dogma, but you're missing the heart of it all. Question, who are the people who really embraced often the new learning and the new stuff that Jesus was trying to unpack for them? Often the broken, humbled hearts. They're just like sponges. They're just going, hey, help me understand. They were often the truth seekers, asking tons of questions. Just going, help me. Which brings me to stage three and what Scott Peck called skeptic. Now this I find fascinating. You'll notice the skeptic is actually above the person who has it all figured out. This is it. They're just fantastic. Often, he says, this is the skeptic stage is where religion is either thrown out or seriously doubted. This is, again, third stage spiritual development. So where the skeptic, the individual, the questioner, including atheists and agnostics and those more scientifically minded who demand measurable, well-researched, logical explanations. This is where they hang out. Stage three. Although frequently non-believers, people in stage three are generally more spiritually developed than many who are content to remain in stage two. Although individualistic, they are often not the least bit antisocial. To the contrary, commonly these people in stage three are deeply involved and committed to social causes. They're deeply engaged in their community, deeply engaged to caring for stuff beyond the surface, beyond themselves. Typically, and again, these are big, broad swaths that he's making. Typically, they make up their own minds about things. They make loving, intensely dedicated parents. As skeptics, they're typically deeply submitted to principle. Interesting, he closed off his kind of explanation of this stage by saying, advanced stage three men and women are active truth seekers. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was reading these stages, I'm going, yes, yes, and yes. I've watched people who come in and say, hey, just so you're clear, I'm atheist. All right, I'm only here because of the wife. I go, hey, come on in. And they sit there, wrestling, watching. And then after a few months, we'll meet. They're going, okay, I got some questions here. You guys aren't what I was expecting. On this. And what about this? They are just seeking. But you watch them in their life. They are about more than just fighting or arguing. There is a deeper level of spirituality there. I look at them and I go, okay, yeah, okay, you're not ready to acknowledge maybe God is out there, but I'm telling you, you are spiritually seeking. You're after this. I watch people who have, over their lifetime, given up on parts of their faith. They're going, I can't reconcile it anymore. And I think I'm throwing in the towel. I'm not sure. But they continue to seek stuff out and wrestle, try different things, seeking. Many of them end up sitting in these seats here. Maybe that's you. And they're looking for God, but they're just, there's doubt. It's uncertainty. That's why here at Friends Church, we value being honest about what can be proven. We hold this value tightly. We say it this way. We acknowledge that there are beliefs that we as individuals, we hold about life and God and theology. Though we may believe strongly in them, we acknowledge openly we can't prove them. We truly desire to be a community that strives to be honest about those things, who values respectful dialogue, and those who see things differently. There's a lot of things we believe, but we can't prove. We believe that wrestling with our faith and beliefs and God is part, deep part, of the spiritual development process. Do you hear me? I'm going to say that again. We believe that wrestling and doubt and uncertainty is a very critical part of the spiritual journey. And honesty about what we can prove and what we can't, where we have to open up and go, well, we think this is it, but we're not sure. And what that might make you feel like out there, we believe that's part of the spiritual development process. As much as I would love to stand up here and say, okay, folks, follow me. I got the word. Just got off the phone with the big guy. Here's the truth. And don't doubt. I know there's some people who just go, oh, that feels so good. 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 Doesn't make me wrestle. I wish we could do that, but we can't. There have been times, I know one time about a number of years ago, and maybe some of you were in this room. It wasn't here, actually. It was at Masters. I had spoken about the common arguments for the proof of God. How many? Was anyone here for that? And so anyways, there's four really big common arguments Christians have used to say God exists because that. Here's the cosmological, teleological. I shared all these different ones. And let me tell you something. They were good arguments. I like them. But after they're all said and done, I had to look at everyone in that room and go, but listen to me. They don't prove empirically that there is a God. And I remember when I said that, there were some people that were just like, oh no. I mean, I could see fear in some people's eyes, and I'm like going, oh, hang on here. It's okay, though. I mean, there's people going, oh, no, don't tell me that. I remember interviewing two lesbian women on stage Maybe some of you remember that. Remember that? That was a first for our community. It was a whole series on judging. And we had them on stage and we interviewed them to talk about their faith and their deep connection with God. And talk about their spiritual journey and all that they've walked through. And I remember the crowd, 99% of them, standing up and just going, thank you for being a community that can welcome these people and love them and acknowledge that these people are connecting with God and whatever. Huge round of and a resounding support for them. But I remember a percentage of our crowd who were in deep conflict after that morning. They're just going, what? I can't. It threw them into wrestling like crazy. And a number of them came up to me and said, I'm out. I'm not ready to go there. I don't want to be a part of a church that's going to make me wrestle with this kind of stuff. I don't think that this stuff belongs to church. And they're just like, psh, I'm out. It was like, okay. I'm sorry. You need to know something. The reason that we delve into difficult subject matter around here that makes you feel uncomfortable is to highlight the areas that you need to wrestle through. This isn't shock and awe. We're not just doing this to get our thrills and say, oh, this is going to throw them for a loop this week. Get ready. Ooh, people are walking out of here, you know, fetal position. Ooh, you know, we're not wanting to do that, folks. That's not our intention. It's not to make people angry. It's to move people forward, to provoke wrestling, because through that wrestling comes stage number four. Scott Peck said this. He said, one of the great sins of the Christian church is the discouragement of doubting. There's a limit to doubting, he says. If you become really good at stage three doubting, you begin to doubt your own doubts. Oh, I love that. And he says that's when you move to stage four. Let me talk quickly about it. The highest stage of spiritual development. He refers to it as mystic communal. That's his term. I love other-centric. That's something I brought up a couple weeks ago. It's where you're able to look beyond yourself, the bigger picture. Those who reach stage four are spiritual, not looking for clear-cut prototype answers, but desiring to enter into the mystery of uncertainty, living in the unknown. While retaining skepticism, you don't throw all of it out. You don't check your brain at the door. Say, oh, I guess I'm... No. A person at this stage starts perceiving grand patterns in nature and develops a deeper understanding of good and evil, forgiveness and mercy, compassion and love. This person getting to this place doesn't judge people harshly or seek to inflict punishment on them for their transgressions. This is a stage of loving others as yourself, losing your attachment to ego, and forgiving your enemies. A person's spirituality, he says at this stage, differs significantly from that of a stage two person. You know why? In the sense that he or she doesn't just accept things through blind faith or out of fear, but does so out of genuine belief. Out of genuine belief. Have you ever held on to a belief that when someone started poking at it, you began to realize it wasn't really what you believe? It just got handed down to you by someone. Someone said it once, you said, oh, well, that sounds good to me. And you held on to it, and then someone comes and knocks it down, you go, oh. And someone says, why do you believe that? And you're going, I don't know why I believe that, I just have always heard that. When you get to stage four, that goes away. And what you own is your own. Often as I talk about this, people going, oh, so what? We're just throwing all our beliefs out the window? Listen very carefully to me. Through the process of wrestling, through the process of abandoning some beliefs, and over the last number of years, there have been beliefs that I once held on really tight to that I let go. And I've been scared always to tell you what I've let go, because I don't want to wig you out. But in the process of letting them go, and wrestling and sitting across the table as I'm listening to someone else talk to me and share something else, and I'm going, oh, just wait a second, and fighting and sitting with someone else, and what do you think of this? And reading and reading, and what the great theologians of our day said on this thing, and what are commentaries reading on, and back and forth. All of a sudden, something begins to happen where the belief that I hold becomes very dear to me. The difference is, it's mine. I recognize it doesn't have to be yours. And I'm not going to try to make it yours. But it becomes mine. And when someone comes up to you and says, you are so full of... I go, well, tell me how. I'd love to hear this. But I'm not giving it up. Not that easy. Because I own this now. Let's talk. But there is something that comes alive inside. Anyways, keep moving here. I get excited about that one. People say, oh, you're just preaching for an absence of belief. I am preaching for anything but an absence of belief. I am preaching for your own belief, though. You got to own it. And you know what? You can't get to the owning part until you wrestle with it. And I'm not talking about blind faith, defending something you've never had to defend or wrestle with. No, you get it. You get the own belief on the other side of wrestling, where you're willing to let it go. And then you pull back what makes sense to you. What God reconciles inside of you, what you see and what you read. That's all I need to say there. I want to say this. I'm proud of this community. Because if you're still here, after a lot of the wrestling we've done, let me tell you something. We've tried to buck you off a number of times. You keep coming back. You know why? Because I think you believe the same way I do, that there's value in wrestling. Some people say, I just want to feel good after a Sunday morning. I say, well, then you're not looking for a spiritual gym. You're looking for Disneyland. You go to Disneyland. It'll make you feel great. But this is a spiritual gym where you come for a workout. And let me tell you something. I never feel like running into the gym and getting a good workout. Never. But I always come out going, oh, that one put me through the ringer. Hey? But I'm glad I went. That's what we want from you. We want you coming in going, oh, man, my head hurt a bit there. And people come out, they're kind of walking around. We go, good. Yes, they're wrestling. They're wrestling. Because you don't want to just be entertained on a Sunday morning. You want to grow. Because when you grow, you're able to take more water and make an impact in your world. Don't stop wrestling. Period. Don't stop wrestling. And for all of you that have wrestled so much, I just applaud you. Keep going. Keep going. And for those of you in this room who have been freaked out, and many times you maybe you've been on the edge of your seat going, I think I'm going to run. I don't like this feeling. I'm out. I applaud you for not. Because there's probably something inside you that you look out and you look at all that's going on here and you go, something rings true though. Something about this just makes sense. And as much as I don't like this ugly feeling, I mean, I look at what's coming out and I go, oh no, well, there's enough here. I'm just really, I want to believe. Hold on. And don't you dare stop wrestling. I'm tempted to just say, you know, just go to another church. But I'm telling you, don't give up wrestling. Don't give up wrestling. So now, I'm going to close by saying this. If you ever get up after a Sunday morning and you're going, oh, man. Know this, I got a little smile on my face. And you should too. Because I'm telling you, spiritual growth happens in the wrestle. The point isn't stay at three. The point is to move to four. Where all of a sudden, you begin to see in a bigger picture that life isn't about you. It's about you loving God and others. And stuff starts to make sense. And you're okay with the complexity and the vagueness and the uncertainty. You know, in the end, someone else has something under control. Let's pray. God, for every person in this room that's wrestling, God, I pray that you'd hold them in there. And may they understand, God, the process that we all have to go through. There's no shortcuts to understanding you, God. There's no shortcut to experiencing you. Pray, God, we will hold our feet to the fire, that we'll become incredible wrestlers with all the mystery and the complexity of our world. And in it, God, we will move ourselves to greater and greater levels of spiritual growth. In your name I pray. Amen. That's it. Have a great day, everyone. All right, now, hey, just feel happy now for a little bit, all right? Okay, we're good? Have a great week. We'll see you next week. Awesome. Thank you, Alessandra and band. Thank you. You know, we're so blessed to have so much musical talent. If you're here last week, you'll know that we demonstrated a little lack of talent last week. This was amazing. You probably don't know, Sean Edge, he's now played, a couple times, drives all the way out from Canmore for rehearsals on Wednesdays, and then out again today to play for us. So we're appreciative. Thank you, Sean. But we're thankful for all our great musicians and teams that volunteer. It's great. Vince and I are up here to do a couple things. First of all, I wanted to thank everyone for your response recently to our what we call the mothership offering. Really, it was an offering to be able to say, let's take care of Friends Church. We're always taking care of so many other things, reaching out to different countries and help and humanitarian projects. And our community rallied to this mothership offering that said, hey, let's take care of home base. Let's keep Friends Church healthy. So right now the total is just over $50,000 that has come in. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that? Yeah. Congratulations. And thank you for believing in Friends Church, because a lot of great stuff happens here Sunday mornings downstairs at the kids with our students and here. Hopefully this challenges you and provokes you to grow. One thing I did want to do quickly is to be able to kind of turn back the covers, because a lot of people don't really know how finances work here at Friends. I want to just explain a few things. A lot of people don't realize that to make Friends Church as a whole, running all the staff, renting this facility here, our office space, and all the different things that go on, it costs us about $600,000. Maybe we'll have a pie chart up there that will come up the bench, and maybe not. It's okay, either way. $600,000 to make the world go round within Friends Church, out of which we do all the different things we do. What many people don't understand is that of all the offerings that come in, you know, when we pass the DFW plate, which Vince is going to do here in a second, about 60% of that $600,000 is covered by the general offerings that go on, the DFW offerings, PAG, throwing stuff in the plate. There's another 40%, just under 40%, that comes in through what we call a special kind of category, where families from within this community, as well as we get a government grant that's worth about maybe $13,000 a year, people who have a little bit more give over and above what their regular offerings are to be able to subsidize and make sure Friends Church goes round. That's about $245,000 that comes in from different members of our community that say, here, let's just make sure we got enough. Which is kind of standard in typical churches. They say 80% of the money is often given by 20% of the people. And 20% of the offering is given by 80%. So it's just the way it works. We're thankful for people who have a little bit more and they can throw in and subsidize it. This offering that we took, this mothership offering, just so you know, our general offerings, based on our projections, were down about 5% on the year. It's about $9,000. So what we did is we, of the $50,000 that came in, we carved out $9,000. We said, let's put it into that so we make sure that that's flush. So when you look at your offering, we're on target. All right? Everyone goes, woo, all right, we're good. What we're going to do with the other $41,000 is we're going to put it in the special offering, in the special side, to cover up, because that's been lagging a bit lately. All right? So are we good there? Everyone understand what's going on? So when you look in the offering, you're saying, hey, we should be up about $40,000 right now. What's going on here? We're not shading you. We're not, you know, pulling any funnies here. We just want to make sure you guys understand what's going on. All right. Vince.
$13,000 was my first year salary in the Army as a private.
Wow.
So now that I'm out of the military, I think that's where that money comes from. I was allowed to say, hey.
There you go. Vince is out.
We'll so give DFW, it's the First Impressions team is going to come down. And it's Friends Church way, it's our way to donate, as Jeff was talking about. There's lots of different ways to donate. And there's time, there's energy, there's money, there's talent, there's music. My wife and I, we give to two organizations prior to coming to Friends Church on a routine basis, the Calgary Veterans Food Bank, the Alberta Children's Hospital. We spent a considerable amount of time there. But the nice thing about donating here at Friends Church is we don't actually have to do all the heavy lifting to see where we should throw our money to for a donation. So it's really nice to put our confidence in the church, and they figure it out. They do all the heavy lifting to see where all this money goes. Last Sunday was Serve Day, and Carmen, where's your big giant hands? So Carmen helped get Serve Day off and running. I would say about 30 of us went down to Camp Bonaventure last Sunday, and I think there was four people from Camp Bonaventure, and there's just a small army from Friends Church that show up, and it seemed like we were just there for, I don't know, a while anyways, but in 2.5 hours we had stripped picnic tables, we had sanded picnic tables, we had painted picnic tables, power blasted an entire 700 square foot deck. We wiped down every single cobweb that you could ever imagine. We trimmed the hedges back. Our kids were there. They're Hayden and Hudson. They were out picking garbage with Jody, and they thought it was the coolest thing in the world. It was just really nice, and then we kind of finished it all off with a barbecue, and I got Hayden, my daughter, she snuck me 6 extra Oreos, just saying if anyone didn't get an Oreo, I did. So, yes, I'm not pregnant. It's an Oreo. So thank you. Back to the DFW. However you want to contribute to Friends Church is how you decide, but if you do need a tax receipt and an envelope and all that, those, you know, the team can arrange for that. And thank you. Danita and I have been coming since the beginning of the year. We love it here, and we're very blessed and grateful, and a lot of that's all up to you. So thanks very much.
Right on. Thank you. Thank you, Vince, very much. And yeah. Thank you to all of you who carve out time to not just attend a church, but to give back in some way. We think that is what this whole thing is all about. So I'm very grateful. And if you're here for the first time, welcome. Already, there are many people on mass exodus out to BC and whatnot for holidays. How many are getting ready to head out on holiday right away here? Okay, jerks. It's great. I hope you have a great time. We wish you all a great holiday. Those that are taking off, please be safe. And we celebrate people being able to get away and recharge. We're all about that. So it might look like a ghost town over the next couple months. That's okay. That's all right. We'll party on. And they're going to miss out, okay? They're going to miss out. I'm glad you're here this morning, though, because you're not going to miss out. Well, we'll see, shall we?